Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. So, yeah, we did a little, you know, post-holiday show talking about machines that spun into... A little one, yeah, 50 minutes. That spun into a discussion on crapware and the comments. So, yeah, we are all on the same page, I think, on that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you can, you know, live with crapware on your system.
Yeah.
A lot of it just, you know, doesn't do anything. But it's one of those things where... You know, I go and I look at a machine, or, you know, I go to the store even and I take a look, you know, hey, what are some of the machines that are on the shelves? You know,
yeah.
How good are they? If a person goes and actually goes to a physical store and buys a machine, which, you know, I don't know how many people do that anymore, you know, what kind of experience are they going to get? And, you know, I look at Task Manager, you know, just a quick background check on, you know, show processes for all users. You know, what is actually running?
Yeah.
You know, like, so I have a, you know, a bunch of IE stuff because I have IE windows open. A bunch of Intel driver stuff. I have, you know, antivirus. I have OneNote running. I have a bunch of services running. But, you know, all
but
in
you
all...
you can get an idea there,
yeah,
what else on that machine.
You get a really good idea of
and like
of
we keep saying, if you're lucky enough to have a Microsoft store around you, they have the Signature Series machines, and if you buy a machine in the Microsoft store, you're not going to have any of that junk on there. Not that it's junk, but, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, if you're not using it, and you don't need it...
It's junk.
why does it need to run on your system, right?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's just that extra thing that's eating your battery life.
Yeah.
It's that extra thing that, who knows, might be causing an issue once in a blue moon.
Yeah,
right?
And part of the discussion was that, you know, your typical user, your mom or dad user, is not going to know how to do all the stuff that we were talking about doing.
But most people know someone.
Yeah, yeah. But they probably wouldn't be bothered. They wouldn't even know that stuff is there, and they probably are not doing the types of things on their machine that would, you know, require every bit of processing power and stuff like that. So
sure, but I mean, how often... You know, those same people that, you know, they don't know because they're regular users. They shouldn't need to know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they always know someone that is, you know, good with computers, their son, their cousin, their next door neighbor.
Everyone watching the show. You know what we're talking about.
You guys are tech support.
You know what we're talking about.
Just like we're tech support for people around us, you know, you guys are tech support too. I know everybody, when they go and look at one of these machines, they just go, okay.
Yeah.
Let's start cleaning up the machine. And
it's
for those kinds of things, you know, that it saves yourself the headache of cleaning them up.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't offer any kind of benefit, why does it need to be there?
Yeah. Now, I know that we're probably, as a company, we're not thrilled with people putting all this stuff on OEM machines, but we can't dictate it. And as I pointed out in the notes, I'm glad we don't do it. Yeah,
yeah,
because there's companies like Newtek, who their TriCaster is built around putting a big piece of software on our image. And so they wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't allow this stuff. So it does have some benefits. And I don't think that... I don't want to see us get draconian about...
No, that's the great part about the Windows ecosystem, right? Like, all of our OEMs are partners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all in this together. They aren't putting stuff on their systems that are, you know, intentionally bad either.
Yeah.
They go through, they test, they make sure that it works.
Yeah.
But it's not their incentive to have it being, you know, a pristine machine.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, an end user... Again, for most end users, they won't care.
Yeah.
We're attempting to say, hey, guess what, you know... We're not your typical users. If you really do want to eke out every last second of battery life, you know, cut down on the things that you're running all the time.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, well, let's get started with the questions this week. First one we have from Wayne Knapp. Great show, which is why he's one of the first. I prefer to flatten my PC, and here's what you can do to not mess up the driver. And he walks through a process of doing backup image, pulling drivers out of the WIM.
So he's talking about the factory WIM, or essentially a storage file that some OEMs use in imaging of their machines. And a WIM is a Windows image format that essentially takes a disk image, and it's like a big zip file or an archive or a VHD.
Like an ISO.
It's just, you know, another form of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he absolutely does have some great points there, except that not every machine has a WAN file that has the drivers that are like that, or being able to extract the drivers. And it also doesn't account for the specific OEM patches that I talked about before that are given to OEMs in their imaging process. So yes, if there was, you know, a critical driver and you had no other choice, for whatever reason the OEM didn't have it up on their website, or they have a different version that you can't use for whatever reason and you have to get it from that WIM file, then that's great, you can do it. If it's there.
yeah. So good tips. I mean, there's 7 steps here. I don't want to go through them all now. You should post this in our comments for last show, and maybe I'll do that for him if he doesn't do that. But, you know, that's one way of doing it. All right, next question. From his last name's Albuquerque, but I only want to try to pronounce Louise is his middle name. There you go. Hello, Larry and Gove. Love the show. I watch every week. We love you, too. I have a question regarding UAC. My friend's Windows 7 PC is configured to ask for the administrator password when running almost any program, which you say, this is good, in your reply. He created an admin account in Windows to set his personal account as a standard user, and he's the only user of that PC, and you say, still good. This is my question. Is this useful or safest, or is this just paranoid? Isn't the default simple UAC prompt enough to prevent certain software from running without asked? Programs like Microsoft Web Platform Installer do not run, displaying the message, you must have administrative user rights to run this program. I think it's just very annoying and unnecessary.
We talked about something similar in the show, right? You kind of have to balance security with usability.
Yeah.
This particular person found that his machine is still usable by completely separating user state. Mm-hmm. You have an admin user, and if you need to do admin things with that user, you log in with that user. If you're just running normally, you're a standard user, and you know that's kind of how we want you to run.
Yeah.
But we know that there is a ton of software out there that just doesn't work under this paradigm. It doesn't work well. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the whole point of UAC in Vista. Was to, you know, push the bar, get software vendors to understand, hey, you need to start separating out what you are doing using administrative tokens and what you're doing as a standard user in day-to-day life. So I personally like the idea on my home systems. I do actually run as a standard user all the time. If I need to do software installs, I'll log in as an administrator and do it there. I don't run a lot of software that requires admin rights all the time.
Yeah.
If I do, you know, like I like running command line stuff, you know, so I'll elevate a CMD window. I'll do all my elevated stuff in there if I need to. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit better separated because, you know, software doesn't just automatically run when you're in a CMD, right? It's a little bit of state separation.
Yeah.
Or I'll use PowerShell.
Yeah.
You know, so that... While this particular scenario is, you know, not very useful for most end users, this particular user found it useful. It is a higher state of security because you are completely separating state.
It would be a little overkill for me, I think.
Yeah, it's overkill for a lot of people. That's why we don't make it the default.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. All right. Next question. My name is Cheyenne Anik. I'm a fan of your show. Your show is very nice and a brilliant work done by you guys because you're giving us tech support and information about our PCs. Thank you. I should have put this one first. So, all right. So I'm a student and Windows Phone 7 application developer, and I'm running Windows 7 Professional SP1 on a 2.9 gigahertz Core i5 processor, 3 gig of RAM with some optic fibers. My question is, when I debug my application on Visual Studio 2010 SP1, the taskbar becomes freezy or sticks on the icons pinned on it and doesn't save the thumbnails. Instead, I need to press Control-R to run and start a new instance of program. Please help me get out of this.
So I did reply to this one, but I don't think I ever got a response back. It really did sound like there was either a misbehaving shell extension that was loading in the debug process, or a window hook. So essentially, it's something is being injected into the debugging or the debuggee and is not responding to window messages correctly, and that's affecting, unfortunately, the chain of events of all of the other apps that are currently running and Explorer. So what you'd really want to try and do is when you're debugging that particular application, you can attach another debugger to it and actually figure out what is being loaded, what other than your components and Windows components are being loaded into that process. You might just have an errand window hook that should be removed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right, next, Dave Will, you guys have mentioned multiple times to flatten a machine when in doubt or is the best way resolution, all the while stating it doesn't take long or takes 20 minutes and you're back going again. How? Reloading a coworker's machine typically takes 4 to 6 hours from start to finish. Easy transfer wizard and loading the OS is easy, but determining and reloading all the previously installed software takes far longer than 20 minutes. Well, there's kind of a trick part of this question for you anyway.
Yeah, it was a trick question. He mentioned a work machine.
Yeah.
I'm going under the assumption of a home machine, which typically has far less software installed.
And you also don't install a ton of software. You're pretty much a vanilla Windows user when it comes to
a minimalist.
Yeah.
You know, I will install key pieces of software that I need. I will look for portable versions of software.
Yeah.
So things that don't actually have to be installed.
Mm-hmm.
They can just be run off of a network share.
Yeah.
I don't save files locally. I don't save documents locally. All that goes to a server.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I will also do things to, you know, help prep a machine for being rebuilt.
Yeah.
So I'll take a machine. You know, first thing is if I'm rebuilding, install the OS clean, install any relevant service pack if there's one available. And then install Windows updates.
Yeah.
Okay. And at that point, it's like, okay, now I'm good. Now I'll take big pieces of software, Office, Visual Studio, anything that's really complex or takes a long time to install.
Yeah.
Install that. Install all the patches mm-hmm. for it. At that point, I'll take an image of it. I'll back up that system as is.
Yeah.
That way, when you restore, when you have to rebuild it and restore it, that part doesn't take a long time. And then all you have to do is look for patches since the last time you took a backup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you keep kind of that kind of state separation for personalized data off somewhere else, favorites you can have synced through Live Mesh.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that you can just store up in the cloud. It's not tied to your machine. It roams with you. So you can save yourself a lot of headache if you know ahead of time, hey, if I'm going to be rebuilding, what is the least amount of work that I got to do to rebuild it or to get up to a working state the next time around.
Yeah. So if it makes you feel any better, Dave, it takes me longer than this to rebuild a machine, a couple hours maybe. But one of the things that does help with me is that I have on my massive multi-terabyte archive, I have a directory that's just all the drivers for mm-hmm. the machine. I have a directory.
But do you go updating those drivers?
Not yeah, it depends. I mean, if it worked, it worked, and a lot of times I won't. But it depends on how long it was before the last time I flattened before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have another directory of all the software that I install that's pretty simple. Or I put an underscore before in my big root directory of all the software I use, the ones that I am always installing, I put an underscore on them so that they show up at the top of the directory.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, a couple of things. It makes it a little easier for me, but it does take me a little bit longer. Oh, your flicker stopped on your machine. That's good.
Don't breathe.
Yeah. All right. So
it's funny. You sort by putting an underscore. I just sort by date.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff that, you know,
I might have, like, saved something in that directory that I really don't care about, and then it's the most recent. It would show up at the top, and it's really not one of the things I always install. So an underscore tells me this is a more important directory than others, or for some reason I want it to be at the top. So,
and
again,
you don't
that's.
Use tags?
No. I should. But again, this is something that's been ingrained in me since DOS days. So, I mean, I've done this since, you know, Norton Commander. And
it's funny, old habits really die hard.
Yeah, they die really hard here.
Which is so funny for software development, right? We are constantly pumping out new things every few months. Like the technology is changing so fast, yet we are so ingrained.
Still doing underscores.
You're still using underscores. I mean, that's hilarious.
That's just the way it works, so don't try to change it. All right, so from Klaus Nielsen, he says, I've been installing a lot of Windows client operating systems going back to Windows 95. What's always been nagging in the back of my head is the block size of drive partitions. Is it possible to adjust that for the operating system partition where Windows is installed, even just theoretically? With the larger disk and larger files that we use on a daily basis, one could argue for larger block sizes. The general rule is that larger block sizes would allow for more speed, but if you have a lot of small files, you should be careful creating two too large block size files, too large block sizes. Mm-hmm. Microsoft has an article on this from TechNet, CC767961.
It's from years ago, though.
Yeah. Choose a volume cluster size based on the average type and size of the file that the volume will store. The article goes on to calculate this stuff, which is properly why Microsoft recommends 4K for operating system partitions. Is this still valid?
So, yes and no. What you really want to do is try not to second guess the OS when it's setting up.
Yeah.
We really highly recommend, if you're installing a fresh OS, to let the setup, the built-in setup, actually format the drive for you,
yeah,
as opposed to formatting the drive ahead of setup. Because, yes, as time goes on, things may change and it may optimize better. I don't know if you notice this with Win 7, is when you install, you get the system partition.
Yeah.
You know, that 100 meg or 200 meg system partition, right? If you have previously set up your partitions and you just install to it without formatting first, you don't get that partition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so setup has smarts about, hey, I need to have a particular layout, or my optimized layout is blah.
Yeah.
And setup will do it for you, which is really what we want you to do. Stick with known good defaults.
Yeah.
As opposed to try to second guess it. Now, I know of, like my own system partition, I use Hardware RAID, and ahead of the OS, it sets the right cluster size.
Mm-hmm.
And I just tend to not worry about it. Let the RAID system, because it's the one that's talking to the actual hardware,
yeah,
deal with it.
Yeah.
Let setup format it the way that it believes that it should work.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is the OS, so we are talking significantly smaller files, because they're mainly system DLLs. Those,
yeah,
those are the ones that we tend to care about. We don't have a lot of really huge files on the system.
Mm-hmm.
We also tend to recommend for these types of systems where you're really worried about block size and slack space. If you're storing a lot of data with large file sizes, predominantly, you know, multi-megabyte, multi-gigabyte sizes, store them on a data drive, and you can format it whatever you like there. You know, you can go to 64K sizes if you,
yeah,
wanted to.
Wow, okay. Yeah, I always tend to do that too. Whenever I do a setup, I just blast the partition in, mm-hmm, setup and just let it start fresh. And so, yeah, okay. All right, so that's the questions from last couple shows. So you had something you wanted to talk about, UPS systems.
UPS systems. I know a lot of folks in the tech industry would know this, maybe not so much for home users. They're uninterruptible power supplies. Back in the day, you know, I've been running with UPSs for, you know, 20 years now.
Yeah.
It's really, really recommended in the business space. Home space is just not really thought of,
mm-hmm,
right? But it's extremely handy. We had some power outages here at work over
the
holidays.
Yeah, we've had a lot of windstorms.
Yeah, up in the Pacific Northwest, we get a lot of windstorms here, and they knock out power.
Mm-hmm.
I know my dev box, I came in one day, and power is out. I had a long-running process running in the background, and guess what? I lost, you know, about 2 days' worth of work on that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, not going to happen again. You know, I went and did some research, and oddly enough, newer desktop systems, they require a very particular kind of UPS,
yeah,
one that delivers pure sine wave,
yeah,
for the power supplies. They're very, very finicky.
So what do you want to look for in a UPS? That's probably one of the things.
That's a top one, is look for something that outputs a pure sine wave.
Yeah.
APC, CyberPower, or, you know, two ones that I keep in the back of my head. As being the best out there.
Yeah.
You might have some UPS systems that you picked up at, like, auctions from, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. Unless it's an APC, which has traditionally produced pure sine wave,
mm-hmm,
it's likely producing square wave output.
Yeah.
Which is potentially detrimental to your power supplies.
Yeah.
So if you're hooking up computer equipment, I highly, highly recommend getting, you know, a relatively cheap 1500 VA,
mm-hmm,
power supply. You can get them for $200.
Yeah.
It's not bad. It's cheap insurance. It gives you clean power. It gives you brownout protection, blackout protection, overpower protection.
I definitely need a UPS. I haven't used one, geez, I don't know, I'm thinking at least 5, 6, 7 years. Mm-hmm. And the main reason that I don't use one is because most of the machines I use anymore are laptops. Yeah. So they kind of have a UPS built in,
exactly.
Which is nice. The other thing, too, is way, way back, I'm thinking like 10, 15 years ago, when I used to use a UPS religiously, because I lived in Florida, which also had power issues, you know, during storm season. The problem that I had is, you know, I'd have a UPS for several years, and then by the time I actually needed it, the battery kind of, like, you know, wrecked the bed for the most part. So
batteries don't last forever.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I guess I probably should be using one on my main desktop machine at home, though.
Oddly enough, you mentioned your laptop. As being, you know, not exactly a benefiting from a UPS because it has a built-in battery.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely true. However, one thing that a UPS will still give you on a laptop is the clean power.
Yeah, and probably spike protection,
exactly.
I suspect, too.
Exactly. Surge protection, spike protection. I don't know about you, but I've gone through multiple power bricks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am,
adapters.
Too. I'm carrying a huge one now because my little one...
Right, and you know, you're constantly plugging it directly into a wall. We go to meetings all the time, you know.
Yeah.
You're plugging them directly into sockets that don't necessarily have surge protection on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that'll take a toll on your adapter.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you... I still really recommend getting a UPS, even if you have a laptop. Mm-hmm. Giving it clean power is very nice. It'll help extend the longevity of your systems. And most really good UPSs have a great warranty and monetary protections on your equipment.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. Okay, good advice. All right, so next is a question that I had. So I wanted to ask you this. What is local disk queue? And I see this on a lot of my machines, and it's a disk that I click on it and I get nothing. I'm not able to, I always think it's like some thumb drive that didn't map right or something. And then I click on it and it doesn't, you know, allow me to click. It doesn't allow me to change the disk drive letter to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So what is this local disk queue?
I am assuming that you've only ever seen it on your work machines. You've never seen it on a home machine.
I couldn't say now, but now you're making me try to... look back and try to figure that out. Yeah, you're probably right, now that I think about it.
It's AppV.
Okay.
It's the application virtualization technology that is able to stream an application to your machine, or essentially it packages it up. Anyways, the drive queue is designed for that. It's not meant to be accessible. It has spurned many questions across the net over the past couple years.
So is it the kind of thing where if I'm setting up a machine and I know I'm going to eventually use a machine at work, I probably shouldn't name a drive queue?
Probably,
does it matter? Will it rename that drive, or would it, like, screw something up, or would it just use a different drive letter?
AppV will always use queue, so it'll probably be...
So don't use queue. Leave it like
Q.
Reserved drive letter or something if you're going to use it for a domain machine.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent, good. All right, next question. Is there some software I can use to record my screen, either all Windows or desktop, in a full screen application, hopefully, and then save a JPEG file periodically to a folder, maybe a screen capture program that will automatically save images several times a minute, or a webcam-type application that would fulfill a similar purpose? Goes on and on. But yeah, Snagit from TechSmith, it'll do that. So
I've used Snagit for years.
Yeah.
A lot of webcam software is able to do it as well. You know, security style software.
Yeah,
it's not too terribly difficult to even write a program that'll do this yourself with a PowerShell script if you really wanted to.
Yeah, and I used to use Snagit a lot more than I do now. Now I tend to use some Microsoft products and Camtasia and stuff like that. Snagit I used for this purpose a long time ago when I was writing a book, to take screenshots for the book, so I wouldn't have to sit and do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that.
We also have if you're creating documentation, and I know this tool is built into Windows, this is the PSR, Problem Steps Recorder.
Yeah, yeah.
It's able to take screenshots, and you can annotate the screenshots with notes, and it'll save it as an MHT file, so you can just run it in IE.
Yeah, I did that recently, and one of the things with the Problem Step Recorder is it tends to draw outlines and stuff around things. So check with your publisher if you're writing a book that's okay, because they might not be thrilled with that. So, yeah, but, you know, lots of options there.
Yep.
All right, next question. I just brought a new laptop with 2 gig of DDR3 RAM. However, my system properties for Windows 7, it's only 1.85 gigabyte is usable. Consequently, when I try to install something that needs 2 gig of RAM, it fails only to detect 1.85 gig available. Is there anything I can do to force Windows to recognize all the RAM in my laptop?
First note, Windows is recognizing all the RAM in your laptop.
Yeah.
It really is. It's the problem is that your video card or some other piece of hardware is reserving memory.
Yeah, so we talked about this. It'll take however much memory your video card has and back that much out, and so, yeah.
So, yes, Windows is using all the memory that your machine is allowing it to use.
Mm-hmm. So, no, you can't really do anything beyond that.
You get more memory. Yeah, you get more RAM. And if you do that, install a 64-bit OS if you're currently using a 32-bit
one. Yeah, yeah. Okay, next question. How do I remove the locked icon once a shared folder has been stopped from being shared?
So the locked icon is...
This is where you see a folder and it's got a little lock down in the corner. Mm-hmm. And so usually you might see that if you share a folder, and then if you unshare it, you might expect that lock to go away. But it didn't in this case, so...
Well, the lock isn't necessarily showing anything about sharing. Mm-hmm. The lock is saying that the permissions on that folder are different than the parent permissions.
Yeah.
And they're not inheriting the exact same permission, so it's saying, hey, this folder is a little bit different.
Yeah.
If you want the lock icon to go away, you can just make sure that the permissions are matching the parent folder.
So you can change the parent or you can change the child, yep. But either way, if they match up, that icon disappears, and if they don't, then you're going to see it.
Yep.
All right. Okay, next question. In Windows 7, Alt-Tab now only displays windows that have a taskbar button. Windows without a taskbar button are not showing up in the Alt-Tab list. This is somewhat annoying to say the least. Windows without a taskbar button obviously cannot be selected via the taskbar. They can't be selected via Alt-Tab now. The application question is a legacy pre-Vista app that simply creates a simple window without a taskbar button. Windows XP displays the task switcher. Windows 7 does not.
You can... No guarantees, but you can try using the Win key tab to cycle through.
So the arrow tab, and it might show it there.
Yep. The other thing that you can do is run Task Manager and actually go to the Applications tab and see if it shows up there.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, there's a couple of options there, and let us know if that doesn't work for you. All right. Pick of the week. Pick of the week. So we're going to talk about Perfio.
Yeah, Perfio is a new tool that's been released. I wanted to point out to Vance Morrison's blog. He talks about this tool in pretty big detail. It just makes it a little bit simpler for you to view performance data, ETL traces.
So you use
and
this
a lot
for...
of help, which is really nice. You know, yeah. It actually has documentation.
So you'd use this for troubleshooting, like, you know, CPU issues,
any
memory?
Kind of perf analysis.
Yeah. Excellent. So we'll link to this in the show notes. You can go check that out and download that now. And, yeah, one more tool, one more arrow in your quiver.
Yeah, it's based on XPerf. It's just a much nicer UI and, you know, grouping, being able to... you know, visually analyze it a lot easier than XPerf would.
Excellent. All right, and that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and we now own the email address defrag@microsoft.com, I'm happy to say.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Either one would work. But, you can email us on the show, or you can leave us a comment in the show notes, and we'll get back to you, but we prefer an email in case we have to do a little bit of back and forth. So thanks for watching.